Well, thank you both for that lovely joint introduction. I'm very flattered. And I want to thank you for inviting me to share my work with you this evening. As you'll hear, I think, in my talk, the work I'm doing now, I couldn't do without specialist rare book collections such as this. And it's an even more of a treat for me to speak here in a collection that is dedicated to the history of contraception as well. Very specialist, the best in the country. It's a real thrill for a historian of reproduction like myself to be able to share my work with you this evening. Everybody hear me okay in the back? Are you doing all right? Good. Well, I'm currently writing a book about one of the most long-lived and popular books about health ever written in the English language. The book is called Aristotle's Masterpiece, and I'll tell you right now, it's not by Aristotle. More on that in a moment. And it's not usually considered a masterpiece either. Let's see if my clicker can work.
Oops. Let's try that again. Here we go.
Here, the book is first published in London in 1684. Here is the title page of the first edition. As you can see, it's almost like a little table of contents. And as you can see, the book is going to tell you about conception, pregnancy, labor and delivery, and care of the newborn. It's basically a pretty typical midwifery guide from the late 17th century. But it does have two little twists that distinguish it, and they both come right at the end. I'll see if I can highlight those for you. It has a word of advice to both sexes in the active population, so it actually talks about sex. Most midwifery books pick up the story after that. And pictures of several monstrous birds drawn to life. So it's going to talk about monstrous births, the birth of grossly deformed infants. Now, we don't know who actually wrote this book, and they didn't actually write it in any way. It's basically pasted together bits of two 16th century books that someone basically cut and pasted together and published as this book. It's probably called Aristotle's Masterpiece as a nod to the fact that Aristotle is the leading classical authority on generation, on what we would call reproduction. But Aristotle was also known in the popular culture of 17th century England as something of a sex expert. I know, not the Aristotle that we knew. For example, I have wonderful evidence from plays. In Thomas Middleton's 1602 play, The Family of Love, a doctor's wife diagnoses pregnancy in another woman. She says, "Aristotle speaks English enough to tell me these secrets." So clearly Aristotle is somebody that knows about sex. Now, unlike other 17th century midwifery books, the masterpiece became an enduring success on both sides of the Atlantic. By the middle of the 18th century, there's more editions of the masterpiece than all other popular books on reproduction combined. It spawned multiple versions and a few other pseudo-Aristotle texts, books that aren't really by Aristotle. Let me show you that. Oops. So, there's the masterpiece, and then the problems which predates it, the midwife and the legacy, and then by the later 18th century, those first four books are combined into the delightfully, misleadingly titled Aristotle's Works. I've seen many early 19th century New England editions bound in brown leather, and just says discreetly on the spine, Aristotle's Works. You'd never know it was really about sex. It was still being published into the 1930s, largely unaltered textually. And I have a reference, a couple of tantalizing references, to it being for sale in the 1950s. It's in a Charing Cross Road bookshop in London, stacked high, next to copies of Mary Stope's Married Love, a pioneering book on contraception from the earlier 20th century. I actually think it's the book that ultimately puts the masterpiece out of business. So I think it's very entertaining to think of them stacked side by side in a bookshop in the late 50s. So on average, at least one edition of one of these works is published every year for 250 years. So if your great-grandmother or your great-great-great-great-great-grandmother lived in the Anglo-American world and had a book on sex and making babies tucked up in her sock drawer,
very likely this was the book. So for me as a historian, the book is really intriguing. First, because of its sheer ubiquity and incredibly long life. In part because it is so ubiquitous, references to it pop up in the historical record like no other book of its type. Tonight, in fact, I'll share with you a couple of the stories I've collected about actual people reading this book. Because reading is often a silent activity, it doesn't get recorded much. And if, like me, you're interested in ordinary people, not wealthy people with fancy private libraries, well then finding out about reading practices can be a challenge. Second, the book is significant because I'm interested in vernacular knowledge, ordinary people's understandings of their bodies in the natural world. I think books like The Masterpiece give us a small window into ordinary people's beliefs and practices, however mediated, difficult to interpret, etc. Third, I think the book's extraordinarily long life has interesting things to tell us about the history of sexuality on both sides of the Atlantic. And of course, part of my project is to understand how it is that a book like this continues to appeal to readers when everything around it changes. Theories of reproduction, gender roles, ideas about male and female sexuality, infant care practices, childbirth, all these changed dramatically from 1684 into the 1930s. And yet, the book goes right on selling. As a historian, I want to understand how and why that is. So this evening, I want to give you a kind of sample of some of the ways that this book is interesting historically. It's a kind of taster menu. I've chosen two themes to highlight. The first is about the book's readers, and the second is a particular theme in the contents of the book. So one of the reasons I first started working on The Masterpiece was the stories I had stumbled across about ordinary readers interacting with the text. Very unusual to find for this kind of reader. For example, I read a story about a guy named John Cannon. He was born in Somerset in 1684, same year the book was first published. He grew up in a farming community in the southwest of England, until he, at the age of 23, took up a commission as an excise officer. He traveled the country, basically, his part of the world, making sure people were paying their taxes the way they were supposed to. And he gives us, later in life, he actually wrote his memoirs. This is what they look like. They're still in the Somerset Record Office. Very unusual picture of provincial life. Very rich, very detailed. For example, he describes in the book how he was taught to masturbate at the age of 12 in a group swimming, bunch of boys go swimming. We don't find this kind of stuff very often. Now, as a teenage agricultural laborer, he seems to have been an avid reader. We see a lot of stuff about him borrowing books from people, this kind of thing. He purloins his mother's copy of Aristotle's Masterpiece and another midwifery book she has. He noted in his memoirs that he stole these books from his mother because he wanted to know what women looked like underneath their clothing. When his enraged mother took the books back, he then proceeded to spy on the family's maidservant when she went to the outhouse. Some decades later, the English radical tailor Francis Place tells us in his memoirs that he read The Masterpiece while a schoolboy in the 1780s. And I quote from his autobiography, from his memoirs. "This I contrived to borrow and compared parts of it with the accounts of the miraculous conception in Matthew and Luke. And the result was, in spite of every effort I could make, I could not believe the story." So basically, he reads this book and decides that the biblical account of the conception of Jesus has got to be all wrong. There's no way that this can hold up. Now, what's so intriguing to me is that this means that Place is, in effect, reading the book in a way contrary to the way it's set up. Here's the introduction. It sets up, the whole book is framed in this discussion of the wonders of God's handiwork. Okay, it quickly moves on from that and starts talking about your daughters and why you ought to marry them off fast. But it frames the book as being in this relatively theological context. But Place reads it counter to the way it says it should be read. Now, on our side of the Atlantic, there's a wonderful moment in a cheesy novel from the 1840s when a character goes into a bookstore and buys, yes, The Masterpiece. This novel, it's called The Green Family, is typical of sensational potboilers produced in the 1840s and 1850s. Characters are poisoned, kidnapped, abducted, seduced, etc. on every page. It's a real page-turner. But novels like these weren't keepers. Respectable libraries would never have owned them. And today we only have two copies of this book that survive that we know about. I was fortunate to read one of those in a library in Massachusetts. The novel is set in Hartford, Connecticut, and it claims to be a thinly veiled expose of the evil doings in the town. At least one reader bought the idea that this was actually a roman à clef, because in the copy that I read, this reader in pencil noted in the margins what he thought or she thought the real names of the characters were. So they really knew their Hartford. So, here's the moment.
Yes.
When our hero, James Green, buys Aristotle's works, his roommate drags him off to Peter Cook's bookstore. He says, oh, you haven't seen anything yet. You got to come to Cook's. I'll show you what you really, you know, you haven't seen anything. It's located under the Connecticut Hotel in the middle of town. Now, there was actually a bookstore in Hartford, Connecticut at that period called Cook's. I've looked for it and found it. But it wasn't Peter Cook, it was Oliver Cook. From what we know, Oliver Cook's bookstore sold a lot of religious and devotional works. So maybe the author's having some fun at the expense of this staid businessman who sells religious books. Or maybe, like many other booksellers, the staid Oliver Cook has a nice sideline in books that he sells from under the counter, like the masterpiece. But there was a Peter Cook who had a bookstore in Albany, New York. And that Cook specialized in selling racy books, just the kind of books that our hero James Green wanted to read. The Green family was actually printed and published in Springfield, Massachusetts, not so very far from Albany. So maybe there's a connection there, I don't know. But as you'll see, the reader
who marked up the copy,
I'm sorry you can't see, it's so dark. This slide turned out really dark. That little arrow shows you, they penciled in B. Cook. So now we've got three cooks,
and I don't know which one.
I don't have any good data on any B. Cook. So maybe it's a nod or a wink to the one selling racy books. Maybe it's, you know, outing the local devotional bookseller. We'll never know. But what I like about this is that it's a really wonderful example of the way young men transform a book on midwifery into an illicit, titillating read. Now, the more astute of you may have noticed that all three of my stories so far of actual readers are all about male readers. Unmarried adolescent males at that, not the usual target for midwifery books. When I first realized I was piling up stories of male readers of the masterpiece, I got a little discouraged. Because really, I'd started this whole kind of project, I'd started working on popular texts, as a way into thinking about women's knowledge about their own bodies. However mediated, distance, problematic that might be, that's what got me into it. And here I keep finding boys reading the book. In fact, I'd say that's the something blue of my title. Something borrowed is the text it's made from. Something blue is definitely this kind of titillating edge to it. But I realized at least two factors help explain why I keep finding these male readers. First and most basic, in early modern England and into early America, men were more likely than women to be able to write, because reading and writing were taught as separate skills at school. It's not like today when kids hold crayons and make their letters and learn to read reading and writing all at the same time. These are sitting as completely separate skills. So it may well be that many girls learned reading, but they didn't learn writing. Maybe they learned needlework or something. Whereas boys would have learned, more likely, reading and writing. So women may have been reading the book, but they may not have had the skills to actually write down that they were reading it. Second, as you've noticed, when young men read the book, it's transgressive. They're not supposed to be doing that. John Cannon's mother comes after him in a hurry, not because it's a bad book, but because he's a teenage boy, he shouldn't be reading this stuff. And that's the kind of moment that gets written down because it's exceptional, rather than a typical moment of a woman looking at a book quietly that was in her sock drawer. So I've come to realize I need to find the evidence of women's readership in less direct ways, that women did read it, but I'm unlikely to find the kind of juicy stories that I've just told you about women readers, except, well, when we get to the 20th century, there's kind of a game changer. I'll tell you about that in a minute. So I've been looking for other kinds of evidence. Sometimes women wrote in their names, such as in this copy in the Library Company in Philadelphia. I'm fairly certain that this Louisa Champion was born in England and emigrated to Iowa with her blacksmith husband. At the time she penned her name in the book, She had four children. Now, if four was enough for her, and she'd been hoping to find information about contraception in the masterpiece, I'm afraid she was out of luck. The masterpiece does not discuss contraception, even in the backhanded, inferential ways that some other texts do. So, no luck there, if that's what she wanted. Or, there's this book, which is in our own collection at Hopkins. Well, you can't really see it. It looks awfully dark, but it is inscribed, A.D. Law, 56 Foxbury Road, Broccoli. We can trace her in the census records. She was born Alphonsine Desiree Mahier in Rouen, France, around 1858. When she was 20, she married Thomas Law, a Thames waterman, who ran a barge. A waterman is a typical London working class occupation. He was a lowly member of the company, the Guild of Watermen, but it's basically poorly paid and intermittent kinds of employment. They moved to this address. It's in Deptford, south of the river, near to the river where he worked, sometime between 1891, when she was 33, and 1901. In neither of those censuses is she listed as having any children. So we might imagine she may have had reason to own a book about reproduction. Motherhood and maternity was very highly valued in the London working class communities in which she lived. Sadly, she still had no children listed in the 1911 census either, when she was 53. So I have this kind of incidental evidence of individual readers owning the book who wrote their name in it. By the early 20th century, I do have a new kind of source, which offers me a couple of very rich stories about women readers. That source is working class autobiographies, often written late in life, sometimes published by very local small-scale publishers, sometimes the result of a pioneering oral history project in their area, very variable set of texts. Here's one. This is by Mary Burton Shaw, who grew up in Manchester in the early 20th century. And she tells us she first encountered the masterpiece when she was about 14, I think, maybe 15. She was working in a cap and hat factory in 1920s Manchester. She and her workmates pored over the book at lunchtime in fits of giggles until their boss caught them at it, and they were incredibly embarrassed. In fact, they were so ashamed, she writes, that afterwards they felt dubious about men, like the whole sex. And they assiduously avoided walking down the street in their neighborhood where they knew there was a VD clinic. They were so embarrassed, they didn't want to be associated with anything to do sexual. However, when Mary's mother fell pregnant the following year, Mary was still living at home, Mary visualized the fetus growing inside her mother's body from what she remembered of the illustration she'd seen over lunch in the masterpiece. I love this story because it's a fascinating illustration of how the same book could initially be a kind of entertainment, and then a source of shame, and finally, a source of something like biological knowledge, all in the space of about a year. Now, I've told you some stories of readers, and you can perfectly well say to me, hey, that's just a handful of people. That's just a few individual readers. And I'd say, yeah, you're right, absolutely. But my goal is to use these unusual moments when a reader writes her name into a book, or a rakish young man walks into a fictional bookstore, to develop a sense of the range of ways that people interacted with this book. In other words, all I'm going to be able to provide you with in the end is a kind of scattergram of little dots of actual readers. Now, I do have a lot more stories about readers, so there'll be a lot more dots on my scattergram. But tonight I can just give you a hint of what I think that's going to look like, or one of the things I think it's going to tell me. One of the reasons for the book's extraordinary success is the way that it continued to speak to both men and women. It offered men glimpses of sexual knowledge that they weren't really supposed to have, at least at that age. And it offered women that knowledge plus a practical guide to pregnancy and childbirth. In later versions of the book, it has added sections at the end that I think it make it even more useful for household use. It has either 8 or 16 pages of recipes for common home remedies. I love it. They're supposed to be Hippocrates' own home remedies. So it has a kind of portmanteau feature, where if you had this book, you could cover some realm of domestic medicine. If you were in a family that didn't have many books, it could have some utility. In other words, I think the key message of my scattergram is that this is a book that was read in multiple ways by multiple audiences, possibly even more so than many other books. Now I want to change gears and talk a little bit about what these readers were actually reading, what's actually in this book. Most of the masterpiece, as I think I've suggested, is similar to other midwifery manuals of the latter half of the 17th century, books that were written for midwives, but more important, for married women, to tell them it's kind of the what to expect when you're expecting of the late 17th century, to be make a kind of crude analogy. However, there is, I think, a distinctive theme to the information it presents. And that theme, central to the book, is the problem of resemblance. Why children look like their parents most of the time, but not always. This issue was highlighted right at the front of the book. Here's the frontispiece to the very first edition. Now, I've published on this image. I don't want to talk about it tons, but I also don't expect everybody's always read everything that I've ever written. So, here's the frontispiece to 1684. Who are these two people? First of all, they're not mother and child. They're not related. They're not a child of black parents. That child has white parents. And that hairy woman, those funny little woodcut things, those are supposed to be hair. She's not the product of bestiality or of sleeping wild in the woods for too long or any of the other reasons you might evince in the late 17th century. Both of these people look the way they do because of what is called the theory of the maternal imagination or maternal impression, very widespread theory in the Renaissance. This is the idea that what a pregnant woman sees can impress itself upon her fetus, either what she sees or what she imagines directly. So pregnant women, for example, were told not to go to executions in early modern England because they might see something really gruesome and that would impress itself on their unborn child. So, that black baby, why is that baby black when it had white parents? Because in the marital bedroom, there was a painting of a black man on the wall. And when they were having sex at the exact moment of conception of this being, the mother's eyes strayed to the painting on the wall. And zing! It's as if the image goes right into her eye, right through her body, and impresses the new being at that moment. And that baby is born black. I want to say it's not about race as we think of race. The story is very often told the other way around, that it's black parents who have a white baby, and there's a particularly comical version that circulates where a princess is accused of adultery because she gives birth to the wrong color baby, and Hippocrates himself gallantly comes to her rescue and explains there's a natural reason for this. The hairy woman is the result of much the same kind of process. Her mother had been praying to a little image of St. John the Baptist while she was pregnant. The image was of him in his desert father years, dressed in a camel skin. And her frail and perfect female mind saw this saint dressed in animal skins and transmuted it into a hairy person. And thus her daughter was born a hairy woman. Now, of course, in Protestant England, there's an extra kind of frisson of awfulness about the story, because she shouldn't have been worshiping a little image of a saint anyway. That's not what good Protestants do. But these stories aren't just in England. They go all over Europe. They're together in this picture because of a moment in a print shop. A woodblock maker carves them in the same image in the late 16th century in a book on monsters and prodigies. And they then cohabit in the same frame for hundreds of years. But they're not actually related to one another, except that they have the same reason for looking the way they do. This actual image is a recut, this is the frontispiece to the masterpiece, is a recut of a picture that was used in the English edition of the collected works of the famous French surgeon Ambroise Paré, published in London in 1626. Somebody needed some pictures, and they flipped through the book of Paré they happened for some reason to have on hand, or they reused the woodblocks they had on hand. And so then this became a very common practice. This becomes the frontispiece to the masterpiece. And this image becomes like a trademark. I want to say one more thing about the maternal impression before we look at a lot of frontispieces. I think that the implications of the theory of the maternal imagination were somewhat threatening to patriarchal society. It suggests, first of all, that women's weak and idle imaginations could disrupt their children, could mark their children, and more deeply, that women had the power to disrupt a paternal line, the transfer of qualities from father to son. Worse yet, the masterpiece actually used this theory to advise women on how to be successful adulterers. The book tells you that if you're having sex with your lover, imagine your husband at the crucial moment. Because that way, if you get pregnant, the resulting baby will look like your husband, like it should, and not like your lover that you're actually with. Now, you think it sort of takes the edge off of adulterous sex, but I want to underline how profoundly subversive this idea is. That is telling women how to get away with it in a culture where men deeply, deeply feared being cuckolded, deeply feared that their wives might be running around on them. This is a world in which women were the more lustful sex, and so women's desire was a powerful and dangerous thing, and this book is telling you how to trick your partner. So this image, with its commitment to the theory of the maternal imagination, becomes like a trademark for the book. Here it is in the 1720s, they're walking into the philosopher's study. That Renaissance magus on your right is actually supposed to be Aristotle. This is from the 1770s. This is upstairs. Sorry, can you hear me okay if I talk when I'm looking at them? Do you want me to back a little bit? This is actually in the collection here. It's a Glasgow edition. From 1772, and it shows us that even when they didn't have very sophisticated woodblock makers handy, and this is a very crude woodblock, they nevertheless spent the money to have it made. They wanted that picture there. This is, she's easily dressed this time. She's lost the baby. But in this version, this is in our collection here. It's fantastic. This is 1822. She's lost her hair, and the baby isn't black anymore. He's white. But same image here. This is also in the collection here. A wonderful copy. This is 1826. And here, the philosopher is really interested. She's got no clothes on. And then we've got this one from the 1850s. This is an especially lovely copy that's here. It's colored. This is a very standard illustration from the 1850s type editions. This is only the second one I've ever seen colored in like this. So, still emblematic. By now, she doesn't have hair. She's lightly veiled. It's not clear to me, unless you understood from the text what this picture was about, what it would mean. But it's an echo of this much longer kind of heritage. So I think that this image is like a trademark for the book. If you want to get your hands on Aristotle's masterpiece, when you see that picture at the front, you know you've got the real thing. This picture always means you've got the right book. And what that means is that the book is really committed to this theory of the maternal imagination. So, the theory of the maternal imagination is one way that you can disrupt the transfer of qualities from a parent to a child. You can make that problematic. The book also obsesses about another way that that happens, and that's in the production of so-called monster babies, grossly deformed infants who do not resemble their parents. Of course, every society struggles to explain this very rare event. What does it mean? How could it have happened? The masterpiece provides a range of explanations. Readers really have their choice. It provides a number of different explanations for this. Sometimes it's God's direct intervention, very early modern. The whole society has sinned. God is sending a monstrous being as a warning. Other times it is the parents' direct fault. They've been having too much sex, the wrong kind of sex, whatever. And third, of course, sometimes it's the maternal imagination. The mother has seen something horrible and it's impressed itself upon its baby. And this interest in monster babies is a kind of feature of the book for a very long time. This is kind of rogue's gallery I put together. This is a being allegedly born in Arles, France in 1572. Again, very hairy. And upper left-hand corner is the first version. And you can see they have different versions of this, but this is all the way in the 1850s in the lower right. They kind of keep using this illustration again and again. And even when they kind of mess up in the print shop and they can't quite fit it in, there it is. So they've always had these pictures of monster babies. Again, it's kind of trademark of what this book is actually about. And in the 1830s, the book gets a new frontispiece. Anybody know who those are? Yes. That's right. Chang and Eng Bunker, the so-called Siamese twins, the very first Siamese twins. What I love about this is they get used for the frontispiece within a year of their first American tour. I mean, this is news. This is hot stuff. Some smart guy in a print shop borrowed them. He recut an image from their traveling poster and boom, made it into the frontispiece of the book. Their appearance again poses the problem. How and why children don't resemble their parents in unusual cases. This obsession with monstrosity continues apace for decades. In James Joyce's Ulysses, Leopold Bloom looks at a copy of the masterpiece on a Dublin bookstall and describes the masterpiece's chromolithographs, I don't think they really are chromolithographs, as cataloging all kinds of monstrosity, from supernumerary digits to swine-headed babies. It's typical Joyce. There aren't actually any swine-headed babies in the book, but that's exactly what it feels like when you look at it, so I know why he's saying that. But let me remind you that these hairy women, monster babies, are the exception, not the rule. Children usually resemble their parents, because ultimately, in early modern thinking, they were made from their parents' blood. That's what seed, male and female seed, is a form of, it's like a distillate of the parental blood, so that a being looks like both of its parents. Early modern theories of generation are complex. There's more to say on that. Feel free to ask me later. But basically, that's why you look like your parents, because you're made of their blood. As the early modern saying had it, blood will tell. Likeness seems to be composed less of individual characteristics than it is a whole. Your outer form could be presumed to speak truths about your inner familial relationships, at least usually. But in the 19th century, the meanings of resemblance change, so that I think the same monster babies come to mean something else. Stefan Müller-Willi and Hans-Jörg Reinberger have recently suggested that the concept of heredity created a new epistemic space in the early 19th century. From animal breeding to gardening to medicine, questions about how qualities were transferred from parent to offspring and environment to body moved from the purely practical, how do I breed a better carnation, to the good to think with, to something that could be theoretical. They argued that the very open-ended early modern category of generation was replaced by heredity, a biological model that drew its inspiration from the legal codes of the inheritance of property. That is, a child inherited specific material qualities from a parent, just as he or she might inherit land or money. We use the term inherit unproblematically today. We forget that it originally was a metaphor. Biologically speaking, it's a metaphor drawn from legal stuff. But originally, it had its origins in legal relationships. Now, of course, the concept of heredity in the 19th century was still quite pluripotential compared to our own ideas about genetics. In a way, heredity was interesting and good to think with because it was somewhat open. We think we know what happens, so we obsess on a completely different level. We worry about genomics and our own individual fates in a different kind of way. But the mysteries of transmission, coupled with the profound social implications of such transfers, made the problem of resemblance and heredity compelling in the 19th century. Now, I want to push their work a little bit further by suggesting that generation, as represented in these Aristotle texts, continued to appeal well into the 19th century and even into the 20th century, precisely because it was more open-ended than heredity, and it wasn't modeled on laws about the transmission of wealth and property. Perhaps people who didn't have a lot of wealth and property to transmit did not find a model based on property quite as appealing. Now, I'm going to take a little look at the competitor texts for the masterpiece. If in 1840 you walked into that bookstore and you wanted a book about sex and babies and you didn't buy the masterpiece, what else was on offer? A great many texts. There was this boom in texts on sex and reproduction in the 30s, 40s, and 50s. And many of those, I'll argue, were much more interested in heredity. They offer a reductionist lineal model of the transmission of qualities from parent to child. It's much more a restrictive understanding of the relationship between parents and children. There's a flood of these books like this one. This is Dr. Lacroix's Physiological View of Marriage. It's probably from about 1855. No, I don't really think it was the 100th edition. Sorry, Dr. Lacroix. But probably it was priced for 25 cents. We know that he was a practitioner in Albany, New York, and it seems clear he's publishing this little book on sex and reproduction as a way of building his own local practice. And he offers a standard view of heredity for that period, this lineal model of the transmission of qualities from parent to child. Or, a little racier, there's The Marriage Bed, published sometime in the 1850s in the center of New York City's Nassau and Ann Streets. That's the porn district. And the pictures are standard images of whores from the period. This is the inside of a brothel. I haven't figured out which book they borrowed it from yet, but I'm sure this is an original to The Marriage Bed. It's pretty standard. So the pictures are all pornographic, but the text has a very interesting account of heredity. It promulgates the ideas of a guy named Alexander Walker, who's an Edinburgh-trained physician, who has this unusual theory about the way children inherit the front of the head and the back of the head from each parent. You get the front from the mom or the dad and the back from the mom or the dad. And it depends which one you get, depending on whether your parents are related to each other, whether they look like one another, or whether they don't look like each other and they're not related. It's a complicated theory, but it appears over and over again. He was not a phrenologist, and he tended to be critical of phrenology, but the way he thinks that the head tells you something about the faculties contained within the head made him very sympathetic to phrenologists. And so it's not just that you get the front and back of the head, you get the whole package that goes with that. You either get like beauty and nutrition, or you get reasoning and locomotor skills. So a very gendered kind of divide. It's a very reductionist, materialist account of the transmission of qualities from parent to child. Or on the other side of the Atlantic, we have Robert Culverwell. He's a hydropathic general practitioner in London. He publishes a whole range of books, including, I love this one. It's a tiny little book. It's like this by this. It's a little tiny pamphlet. You can see it says it's given away for free. So if you consult him for something, he'll give you this book to take away. And basically, it also offers this Alexander Walker theory on the front of the head and the back of the head. In fact, it's basically plagiarized Walker. I mean, he just takes it all from Walker's book and packages it in a little pamphlet. Again, it's about the specific material qualities that descend from parent to child. Eugene Beclaert's Physiological Mysteries and Revelations, and I'm sorry, I don't have a picture of this, 1842, many other editions, he goes even further in a restrictive account of heredity. He specifically warns women that their imaginations aren't powerful, and that if they have sex with a lover, that baby's going to look like the lover. So don't think about imagining. He specifically says the myth of Aristotle is a myth. Don't imagine, you're going to get found out, that if you have sex with a lover, the baby will in fact resemble your lover. So, while I think it's undoubtedly a backhanded compliment at best, the model of transmission of qualities from parent to child that Aristotle's masterpiece continues to offer to its readers is somewhat double-edged. On the one hand, it certainly has its misogynist qualities. Women's idle brains can spin much mischief. But it also suggests that women are quite powerful, that their minds cannot be ignored, and that any mere father-to-son model of transmission is quite incomplete. So, as heredity came to be a significant model of the transmission of qualities from parent to child, on offer in a very wide range of books meant for ordinary readers, I gave you examples tonight, but there's countless more. The masterpiece, I think, became a kind of alternative text because it offered a very different way of thinking about that kind of transmission. What had been perfectly ordinary in 1710 became alternative by the 1840s. And I think James Joyce beat me to it. Not only does Leopold Bloom peruse a copy of the masterpiece on a bookstall, it turns out Molly Bloom already has her own copy. She refers to it as, and there's a wonderful Joycean slip, Aristocrat's masterpiece. For it is, after all, aristocrats who are the most invested in the proper lineal transmission of qualities from father to son. Be that an ability to rule, a family resemblance, it is for aristocrats that the problem of resemblance and transmission is its most acute and most pressing. I'd like to close with one more example from the book itself. Here's the last page of a copy of the book in the American Antiquarian Society. Here, a man, or maybe a woman, has treated the book like it is a little family history, writing, "This book descended from my grandmother Sudworth, then to my mother, then to Sister Orpah, then to Sister Nancy Dedown, and then to Nancy McLean." Then he or she writes himself into this female family history. March 1st, 1880, P. Thompson. It shows us the way in which the book is truly something borrowed, something blue, in that it situates sexual relations within the context of marriage and family. But there's an additional twist. Aristotle's masterpiece, a book about kinship as construed in early modern terms, as based upon resemblance, becomes a record of kinship in the model of lineal descent that becomes dominant in the 19th century when it gets written in this lineal family history by this one reader. They've transformed the meaning of the book almost into a different kind of meaning about what family and kinship are, a lineal family history that descends unproblematically. It is just such small paradoxes and ironies that make the book such a pleasure to study. Thank you.
I'm happy to do questions. That's great. Mary, I'm sure we'll take a couple of questions before we go upstairs, but let me say, a couple of things. We have another presentation in January on the 19th on the history of emergency contraception. I hope you'll turn out for that. It'll be a good talk by Heather Monroe Prescott. Also, we have copies. We have three copies of Aristotle's masterpiece in the collection here, but we didn't know it until we were aware of her work. And then we said, oh my, you know, we've got this salacious literature in our library. And I kept my antenna up, and I was in Pittsburgh going to an exhibition at the Carnegie Museum of Art, and across the street in a bookstore, I bought a copy of the one with the chroma lithos for $45. And you can still buy them on Via Libri or other sites that you can search for rare books. So they're out there. Not always dirt cheap, but affordable.
A friend of mine found one on Craigslist recently.
There you go. So I'm going to open the floor up to a couple questions before adjourning up to our reception.
Great question. The story of the black baby is a complex one. The early New England editions don't have any pictures at all. There's a whole bunch of New England editions from about 1800 to about 1830, no pictures at all. Then there are a few American ones with variants, but the black baby is much less popular here than it is in Britain. Now, they're still shipping British books here, but I think it's no accident that in America, what appears to be a hairy white mother with a black baby is really troubling in a land characterized by chattel slavery. That's much scarier. And the notion that there's a slippage potential between parent and child, the resemblance doesn't always speak the truth, I think is really troubling. When here, the lines between black and white appeared so firm, and yet everybody knew that they weren't quite that firm. That there were plenty of children who looked like the master, slave children growing up looking like the master on a southern plantation, that everyone pretended not to notice. I think it was a more troubling issue here, so I think, I'll never be able to prove that picture becomes less common here, and less sort of, there's a way in which taking her hair away and putting her in veils, she becomes a much more open character in the sense of, is she nature, is she beauty, is she truth? She's some philosophical object, maybe. I think she's a little less weird and scary than the hairy woman. So I think there's a kind of, I don't like to say civilizing going on, that's going too far, but there's a sort of, it's become just a wee bit more polite when they move to that veiled woman in the philosopher's study and lose the black toddler. But it's going to have to remain suggestive at that level, because I don't have any documentation about, you know, how they chose the pictures or anything like that. By the 1830s, it's not just Chang and Eng. There's an explosion of different images they use as a frontispiece, as the book bifurcates and becomes both a racy book and a book for married women. It develops this whole panoply of different images. And it's clear to me those are really important in the selling of the book. The printers aren't stupid. They're willing to pay for the pictures. So the pictures are a really important part of the book. It's part of the selling. So I need to pay attention to it. Thanks.
So 250 years is a long time. I assume that copyright didn't play much of a role over its history. To what extent do all the different editions just represent different publishers putting out the same book? How did the sales vary over time? And the book you mentioned that supplanted in the 30s, what were the fundamental differences between that book?
Right, and I can't tell you how stretched I feel as a historian talking about 250 years. The book was never in copyright. It was always flying underneath the radar of regulation. So that meant any publisher who wanted to publish it could publish it pretty much with impunity. So it's a moneymaker. You're absolutely right. What happens is it does get reconfigured in subtle ways. It gets moved around. There's four different versions of it. But I think sometimes it's whatever the local printer had, whatever copy he had, he just copied and printed. I see that in the New England, it's published in some small New England towns in the early 19th century, and I think it's a moneymaker, like you said. So there's a sort of middle area between saying it's just like they Xerox it and reproduce it, and saying they change it completely every time. It exists in some zone between that, because they choose the pictures, they choose the layout, and it does get rearranged sometimes. There's a wonderful New England paperback edition that's about a third of the size. I've only seen one copy. I don't think it survived very often because it was paperbound, sort of almost like an almanac size. There may have been more of those. I just don't know. So it's kind of available for remaking by whoever wants to remake it. In terms of Mary Stokes, I'm not 100% sure that that's really what does the book in. The book is less popular here. There are fewer editions after Comstock, after 1873, the law that forbade shipping contraceptives and contraceptive information through the mails. So a lot of books about sex and reproduction have to become much more discreet in America from that moment on. The English editions just keep on going. And Mary Stokes is an English book. And what it offers is a different version of what the marriage relationship is like that values women's pleasure in a different way. The masterpiece values women's pleasure for sure. It does it in a different way, and fundamentally it talks about contraception. And I think it's actually that contraceptive message that is the stake through the heart of the masterpiece in the end. Because it's clear that its success has a lot to do with a kind of hand-to-hand transmission. That it's a book of one, you know what it is, your older sister tells you about it, gives you a copy. It's that kind of book. It spreads by word of mouth. You do see it advertised also, but it has this kind of underground, very long-term existence that it's only really new information about contraception that finally puts an end.
One more question.
Jimmy? The clip that you had, the Patreon book where somebody's going to take you to Cook's bookstore?
Yes.
Did you notice that a couple lines above that they say something, that the friend says, oh, you mean like books like whatever, and one of the books is, oh, my sister has one of those, it's called Comstock's Chemistry.
Mm-hmm.
And is that a reference to Anthony Comstock?
No, it's before that. It's before that.
Okay.
I should look that up, though. I should look, because whoever wrote that wrote it very knowingly. So I'm sure there was a Comstock's Chemistry or something like that that they're referring to. So I should find out what it is, because maybe for all I know it's another one of these type books.
Before we go, I want to indicate we've got an exhibition upstairs. The title is Mothers, Monsters, and Sex, Reproduction and Childbirth as Seen in Aristotle's Masterpiece. And Jillian Seaman did most of the work on that. It's senior at our college here, and if you have any questions, it can be addressed to Mary or to Jillian about that. You should stand up, Jillian, because upstairs, we have two ways. We have an elevator at the far side of the building. It'll take about 8 or 9 people at a time. We also have immediately through these doors stairways that wind directly up to the gallery space. So let's thank our speaker again.
I'll have to bring my copy next time.
Was how so much of the novel is about the unreliability of texts, whether they're newspapers or the novel itself. And so he's planted something unreliable right in there. Great event, Jim.
Well,
thanks
so
for
too.
Putting it together.
A fountain pen, no less.
Oh.